This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'd like to thank Aaron and Jean-Michel for organizing this event and for their kind invitation. And I'll start with a epigraph from Bill Viola, from his essay, Between How and Why. Talk of machines, technologies, capabilities, costs, markets, infrastructures offers no guidance and is inadequate and irrelevant to the development of our inner lives. This is why art today, traditionally the articulation and expression of the why side of life, is now so important and so vital, even though it remains confused and inconsistent in its response to the new demands and responsibilities placed on it in this time of transition. That's the end of the quote from Bill Viola. And today I want to say just a few things about the project that I've been working on most recently, which is entitled The Force of Art, and attempts to come to an understanding of what constitutes the force of art, that is specifically the capacity of artworks to critique and transform relations which they inherit from the society within which they come into being. And one of the starting points for this project was the sense that at present, almost 100 years after modernism and the avant-garde, and the great promise of the avant-garde, art appears to be less and less significant in social terms. And I suggest that perhaps what underlies this sense of powerlessness and sometimes even irrelevance of contemporary art is the determination characteristic of modernity that reality is somehow elsewhere, that its centers of power are digital technology, economic globalization, and increasing commodification. And it is in that kind of context that I try to raise the question of how we might think about where the force of art might lie. Another starting point is the sense that a lot of modernist and contemporary art, the kind of development of the aesthetic that we can find there, appears to be fundamentally consonant with technicization characteristic of social life. And that with those intensifying social and cultural changes, when we keep them in view, it seems almost inevitable that art would continue to lose its social and cultural status. It is therefore not surprising that aesthetics at the beginning of the new millennium is once again dominated by visions of the end and exhaustion, and that as a reaction, many critics, for example, Richard Schusterman in his Performing Life, Aesthetic Alternatives for the Ends of Art, turn toward areas marginal to traditional aesthetics, popular music, film, mass media, in order to look for vitality and significance of art. Taking an overall view, contemporary approaches to art can be roughly divided into five categories, and I've done it sort of schematically to give you a sense of how one might think about them. The first one would be Hegelian scenarios of art's death and exhaustion. The second one would be the attempts to revive the old terms, the beautiful and the sublime, in order to define the essence of art. The third one would be conceptions that somehow put art on the back burner and concentrate instead on the instances of subversiveness and aesthetic import in popular culture and mass forms of entertainment. The fourth one would be art's apparently progressive fusion with technology, as in electronic or transgenic art forms. And five would be the isolated or interesting, but nonetheless interesting attempts to think art beyond or after aesthetics. My suggestion would be that though quite different in their assessments of contemporary art, these views, perhaps with the exception of the last one, that tries to somehow think art beyond aesthetics, whether trying to refurbish classical aesthetic terminology or shifting aesthetic concerns and critical legitimacy to popular culture, they all confirm, in some sense, the end of art. What I mean by that is that they confess to the apparent absence of critical force in contemporary art. So in response to this kind of impasse concerning art's social function, my approach tries to recover and redefine art's transformative force. And I associate this force with the idea of art as an event, an event which brings into question the continuously growing technicization of modern relations. By technicization here, working with Heidegger's rethinking of the essence of technology, I mean the facility with which all types of things, experiences, and relations are characterized today by their intrinsic availability as information. Everything around us appears reducible to or translatable into information, and as such becomes disclosed as intrinsically open to manipulation, storage, and reprogramming. In other words, reality today transpires in terms of what might be called an informatting, by which I mean the prevalent formatting of reality and its constitutive relations in terms of information. Against this backdrop, I see art as an event in which at stake is precisely this contemporary informatting of reality and the possibility of a transformative turn in it. As Bill Viola suggests, contemporary art finds itself in a transitional stage, no longer capable or willing to play the old aesthetic and cultural roles assigned to it, and yet uncertain, even confused, about its place in the techno world of the 21st century. Technology, machines, and tools, as Viola remarks, function always as engines of how rather than why or what for. And the centrality of technology in modern life and art evidences a shift not only in the manner of art's production, but more importantly, in the very direction of the aesthetic. In the face of what looks like a gradual disclosure of art's basically technological constitution, of the how replacing and altering the why, Viola reawakens the dilemma of art's continuing or perhaps disappearing difference from the technological. The disorientation to which Viola points indeed signals the central dilemma facing art today. Is art part and parcel of the continuing technological acceleration of modern culture, an aesthetic branch of techno power, as it were, or does it mark the possibility of a critical turn, or even transformation in the play of power? My suggestion is that indeed the work of art in the 21st century should be thought in terms of the possibility of such a transformation or turn within the technological. Since this transformative effect of art would occur on the level of force relations, I proposed elsewhere the term force work to describe both what makes artworks distinctive from other objects and what allows art to intervene into social practice. The force work can be defined in a preliminary fashion as a redisposition of forces into a constellation alternative to the socio-historical conditions of art's production. In this view, the work of art is a field, a multidimensional space-time event, where force relations can be transformed through the force of poiesis. Poiesis is, in my view, what makes art possible. It is a kind of force that is specific to art. This poietic force remains, as Adorno and Heidegger each in their own way explained, an enigma, ungraspable and illegible within the discourses, whether aesthetic, scientific, or cultural, which this artistic force itself transforms in the process of inscribing them into artwork. So my idea is that when social forces enter the space of art, they come under the bearing of this force, that is, under the bearing of poiesis, which reconfigures and redisposes them. As such a force field, an artwork becomes an interface between the social world and the artistic dimension of the work, staging repeatedly the very transformative event, the synapse between art and reality, which allows art to remain autonomous precisely for the sake of critiquing and revising the real. Such force work can be thought of as an alternative disposition of forces, as an event which, releasing the force of temporality, not only ruptures and displaces the relations of power that regulate social commerce, but also refuses any kind of grounding. Through such a displacement of grounding, the event of the force work dissolves power, understood as determination and constitution of being. This transformative force work cannot be either limited or explained satisfactorily, as Adorno's aesthetic theory indicates, in terms of the radicality of formal experimentation, or as a thematized resistance to dominant power formations or ideologies. Rather, it has to be considered in terms of the unfolding of force relations, which, as Adorno suggests, like the invisible infinitesimal forces in physics, operate as a second world of relations underneath not only the social and the political, but also the aesthetic phenomena. Let me just add here that, you know, what's interesting in Adorno is that he says that in the work of art, we not only have the aesthetic phenomena, the social and the political implication, implications. But we also have this second world of relations that are operating in the work of art that cannot be completely explained through the social, the political, or the aesthetic. And that's what I'm sort of using here to try to talk more about this idea of the work of art as a field of forces. Thought in this way, the event at work in art concerns art's paradoxical ability to dominate its material or medium in such a way that the resultant work undoes domination and technicization at work in social practice. As Adorno suggests, art transcends specific struggles and conflicts, not by abandoning or forgetting them, but by reinscribing and critiquing them through a radical revision of the domination of nature, characteristic of modernity. The paradox of art lies for Adorno in art's capacity to artistically dominate domination and revise it into non-domination, which resonates with Heidegger's idea of poiesis as a form of desisting from power and disclosing the alternative of what Heidegger calls the power-free. In other words, art is not a matter of addressing this or that form of power, empowerment, or domination, but instead of pointing to the release of relations from the circulation of power. Thus, Beckett's plays, for instance, do not criticize or oppose any specific forms of domination, but in an inverse move, present a world trapped without exit in the routines of power, power that empties the physical and the psychical landscape of his texts of anything save near meaningless repetition. And for example, in Gertrude Stein's texts, power is shown to operate on the level of syntax, to form the grammatical grid of language, thus bringing everything within the orbit of power already in the very act of disclosing experience into words. For Stein, the structuring of reality into a grammar determines being and experience as always already a masculine field of power. In texts like Patriarchal Poetry on Stanzas in Meditation, Stein's playful distension, repetition, and rewiring of grammatical connections between words and phrases shake relationality loose of the grammatical grid of power and undercut the grid's ability to produce and reduce being into meaning. And in this kind of uncovering or shaking loose of power, art transforms the power-bound space of social relations, letting the transformative event reverberate in society. What art's force work does, therefore, is to open inside relations of power and inverse of power, not powerlessness, but what I've called desistance from power, not to be misunderstood as indifference or passivity, but seen instead as a transformation of the very nature of what it means to work and to act. And one way to describe this transformation is as a shift from the opposition between active and passive to the middle voice. Heidegger's critique of metaphysics of production captures this non-violent modality of being in the middle voice through its suggestive distinction between, on the one hand, making and producing, and on the other, letting or releasing. The two German terms that he uses are machen and lassen. And intrinsic to making, according to Heidegger, is always the forming, the producing, and the manipulating of relations and objects into the terms that intensify power and control. Traditionally, making is any form of praxis with a view to the realization of well-defined goals or a telos. As such, it includes a modality of self-realization, which of course can be blocked, postponed, or derailed by opposing forces. Even in the postmodern fluid or fragmentary conception of power, the idea of making, as genetic manipulation, for example, suggests, is a type of relation in which a dominant active force shapes, produces, or subjugates either a passive material or a weaker force. By contrast, letting refers to an active releasement from power, to a transformation in the very mode of relating, which becomes articulated through reciprocal interaction of forces. Insofar as such a letting or releasement is a departure from the binary articulation of domination and submission, of active form and passive matter, it effectively enables a becoming in which forces unfold through each other in a continuously reactivated field of reciprocal shaping. Because in this type of articulation, all forces are both affected and affecting, they unfold in the middle voice, somehow avoiding the passive-active opposition. And it is precisely this modality of relation in the middle voice, predicated on reciprocal enabling, that I refer to as power-free. Letting, therefore, is an event in which forces are reactivated into an alternative modality of mutual enabling and becoming. It is important to underscore here that this event in no way means leaving things as they are, because as they are, things are always already incorporated into the various layers and flows of power. Still, the sense of letting go and releasement does not indicate a forcible reshaping of forces within the nexus of power or conferring external identities upon them. Rather, letting operates in the middle voice, neither active nor passive, forcible nor ineffective. This alternative relationality is not some illusory beyond to power, but instead indicates a critical inflection in the very tonality of power, a change of momentum whereby forces become released from the circuits of power and are given a free space of occurrence. In this context, the artistic force work can be seen as enabling, a transformative work, which radically changes the very momentum of relations. Artworks seek what Deleuze, commenting on Foucault, calls a power of truth, which would no longer be the truth of power, a truth that would release transversal lines of resistance and not integral lines of power, end of quote. This power of truth, which is no longer the truth of power, signifies in my reading a distinctive relational field, an event which grants forces against the pervasive formative operations of power, a space for reciprocal shaping and becoming. I will close by pointing to the implications of this rethinking of the event for the idea of the work of art. First of all, an artwork in this perspective should no longer be conceived as an object, but instead should be understood as an event, that is, as a dynamic redisposition of relations inscribed in it through the sociocultural determination of artistic production. The emphasis placed here on the event of art does not cancel the inevitable and indeed necessary materiality of artworks, but points to the double character of artwork, understood both as an act and as a shaped product. The fact of the physicality of artworks, their necessary existence as objects, with their apparent constancy, highlights the inconstant, volatile, and transformative event at the core of the artwork. This interplay between the thing and the event character of works of art foregrounds the fact that art's force is not at all abstracted from its material existence. On the contrary, I would suggest, materiality performs an active role in art's work, precisely to the extent that the overt immutability of the thing aspect of the work as an object, puts into play its active verb features. Secondly, the idea that the work of art is an active interchange of history and society provides a counter-argument to the notion that works of art are primarily either aesthetic objects or commodities. Gertrude Stein's experimental writings, for example, are never an idealized space of representational nonsense, a disengaged modernist artistic edifice, but on the contrary, they enact a radical dislocation and revision of social forces sedimented in the very interstices of language, in its semantic place and syntactic layers. Stein's idea of writing the thing in itself, that is, in the singularity of its occurrence, is a way of literally rewriting the social practices of disciplining forces, intensities of being, in her words, into the grammar of power. What Stein discloses and reforms are the power-oriented forms of being, reflected in definitions, labels, object naming, etc., that have saturated and become sedimented in the practices of representation and objectification, underwriting both ordinary language and the specialized idioms of literature and science. Finally, perhaps the most significant and yet most difficult aspect of rethinking the work of art as a force work is a radical critique of the logic of production and the modalities of power that together regulate modern social praxis. The idea of production implicit in the aesthetic notion of art as formed content remains, I think, inadequate for the type of performative displacement involved in art. The creation of an artwork, while it inscribes both the forces and the relations of production that regulate its social context, not only exceeds but also revises the very modality of transactions and relations between forces that obtain within the paradigm of production. To the extent that power today is a matter of a certain technicity of rendering everything available for processing, and the shorthand for such availability could be data processing, right? This power is productionist. What I mean by that is that it makes available, renders something ready to be processed and manipulated. The event for me represents an undoing or desisting from such power, which is formative of contemporary reality. I do not mean to say here that works of art are miraculously exempt from power. In fact, each artwork appears to be inscribed with multiple power relations, and while it sometimes remains oblivious of them, it more often engages in a critique or a revision of such power practices. What I call force work, however, operates as it were on a different frequency than such revisions of the power relations. I'm also suggesting that such force work goes further in the specific sense that rather than revising the map of power, that is changing the different power relations that work around us, it instantiates a modality that is released from the workings of power. Conceived this way, the event of art remains critical of power and manipulation, which is characteristic of modernity. That's where I'll stop.
Difficult to stop immediately after such a dense and exciting presentation. I'll return to my own beginnings facing Christoph's work, and what you've heard right now is a summary of the general project that underpins the recent book that is completed and still forthcoming, The Force of Art. And what I loved in this manuscript, having read and so I'm going to show and tell the previous book, The Historicity of Experience, that focuses on modernity, the avant-garde, and the event, was that in The Force of Art, I could see how Christoph would engage systematically with a number of contemporary practices, and I'll name four that he analyzes at length: Bill Viola's recent videos, some of you may have seen, the Telematic Manifesto on the Web, CAC's Green Fluorescent Protein Bunny and Genetic Art, and Orlan's Plastic Surgery Art. These are four examples that we could return to if they are familiar to you. But what I admire in Christoph's book is his ability to discuss them and also to propose a general theory. And this is why I'd like to return to what you just mentioned, the five discourses on art that you see being held today. I just list them again because that was an interesting and useful classification for me. First, Hegelian scenarios of art's exhaustion. Two, attempts to revive the beautiful and the sublime. Three, putting art on the back burner, and like Richard Schusterman, I think some of you know his work, talking about the popular culture, mass entertainment as a new form of art. Four, art's apparent progressive fusion with technology, and we can return to that as well. Five, isolated but interesting attempts to think of art beyond or after aesthetics. And so when I first saw that list, I imagined that you had put your own project among these isolated but interesting attempts. And then I realized that it wasn't probably the case. At least this is my question. Are you in a sixth discourse or in that fifth category? And how can one, as you do, reconcile Heidegger and Adorno when offering another discourse on contemporary art?
I think it depends on the day. Sometimes I think, you know, what I do belongs in category number five. Sometimes I think, you know, it's maybe a little bit different. You know, that's why I have ambivalent feelings about classifying what I do this way. I think, I've written several pieces in which I've floated this idea that it is, you know, which is in a way not a new idea, that it is important to think art after aesthetics. You know, and one of the inspirations for that was Heidegger's essay, The Origin of the Work of Art, when it's pretty much laid out quite clearly that it is necessary in order to think about art somehow to move beyond the aesthetic categories that obtain in that way. And I think there's a way precisely along those lines to think about the relationship between Heidegger and Adorno. There's no way one can completely reconcile them, and that wouldn't be right in some ways because they are different. But my sense was that I could go about it this way, that, you know, on the one hand, I really like the notion that Heidegger illustrates in The Origin of the Work of Art, that what happens in the work of art, when we encounter a work of art, is an event that has a transformative bearing on us. On the other hand, I really liked the way that Adorno is much more engaged in discussions of modernist aesthetics and modernist art. Even though, you know, my way of complicating the scenario was to put them along those lines, but bring in the avant-garde that neither Heidegger nor Adorno really seriously addressed, and see how that particular confluence might be precisely shaped in the works of the avant-garde. And I thought that also it would be interesting to use Adorno, who is very specific and very, very vocal about the importance of the social critique in art, and see how one might correlate the sense of transformation that is there in Heidegger's conception of the work of art with the notion of social critique in Adorno.
I guess I have two questions, basically two questions. And the first one has been provoked by the space, and I love the space, and I think it's great to have both artistic and theoretical events in the same space, kind of uneasy cohabitation, I would say. But I was looking at those photographs while listening to you, Krzysztof, and my question is about perhaps a kind of double relationship to the event. You in your presentation have focused primarily on a kind of event, performative event that happens in the work of art itself as an event and its transformative effects. And I was kind of looking around this exhibition about the stranger and about the refugees, and it's quite clear that this event that this exposition performs also has another relationship to event as a kind of witnessing to the events in contemporary art. So witnessing to the displacement, to the plight of stranger and so forth. So how would you relate those two modalities, work of art itself performing a kind of event versus work of art as a witnessing to horrific and often traumatic events without perhaps performing a certain kind of voyeurism, how to do that kind of witnessing. So that's the question number one. And the question number two is about the kind of comment that you make about the interplay between think character, it's a Heideggerian term, and the event character of the work of art, which is really a comment about art as making and art as happening. And for me, what is interesting in this perhaps tension is the status of the materiality in the work of art. And this has been, of course, as you know, an ongoing reflection or a subject of ongoing reflection, both in the history of aesthetics, even such an idealist aesthetics as Hegelian aesthetics put such a premium on the sensibility of form, all the way to Adorno. But interestingly enough, this question of materiality has been addressed in the context of, in the relation to form, but not to the event. So I'm wondering how one would start to think about it. And the other, of course, line, to just bring some more examples here, I'm interested in this problem of materiality in the context of modernism. and has often been sort of foregrounded as the relationship between form and the body and embodiment, or particularly female embodiment. You can think about Joyce and those textual somatic flows of Molly Bloom, but you can also think about Djuna Barnes, and that was the image that I had when I was listening to your paper. I mean, in particular, the sort of fantastic and enigmatic ending of Nightwit, when you have the figure of femininity engaged in a sort of wrestling match, very surrealist type of dance with the figure of the dog, which in itself is a dialectical reversal of God. So you have this sort of performance of the reversal of the spirit into the matter, and the femininity as the side of this reversal. So a little bit about materiality in relation to the event.
Okay. As for the first one, I think that that this notion of art as a witness to the event, right, I think this would be on a slightly different level than the sense of the event that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that one excludes the other or one is not important for the other. Because the interesting thing for me to consider would be to what extent, say, a piece of art in which you have an explicit sort of witnessing to a certain event, whatever that event is, itself becomes part of the transformative event that the work of art, which witnesses mm-hmm. that specific historical event, whatever mm-hmm. that is, performs in relation to its audience. So in other words, I would see the witness to the event as possibly inscribing itself.
Is it self-transformative?
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if it plays a transformative sort of trick on the audience too, that it does something to the people who encounter the work of art. Not simply as sort of learning something or understanding an event, but that it also does something to their world. Mm-hmm. The second one, it's a difficult question. But now the one sentence that you know, one of the sentences that always stick to me from the origin of the work of art is that sentence where Heidegger writes that it is in the work of art that the material for the first time is disclosed as material. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, this is set over against, and it ties to the question of technology. It is set over against this notion that, you know, in technology, the material is manipulated in order to produce something. You know, Heidegger's examples are tools. You take a material and you produce a tool, but the material often disappears into the tool. For example, we don't wonder what material those chairs are made of, we just sit on them. So the materiality disappears into the function, right? While for Heidegger, in the work of art, it is precisely the material that gets foregrounded. So whether that is, I don't know, a piece of wood in a sculpture, or whether it's the body, or whatever aspect of materiality, for Heidegger, it is precisely the work of art over and against technology that foregrounds materiality, which is simply used up by technology. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I have a few comments and two questions that all kind of address this notion of art being understood as an event, and on the other hand, the event itself as now having become an art practice. So to foreground these comments, it's become somewhat of a cliche today, curatorially, to kind of manifest your interest in the event. Mm-hmm. The event as kind of a practice espoused in the 60s has become very popular. And a number of curators, kind of up-and-coming curators and well-known curators, Hans Ulrich Obrist and others, kind of developed a practice that is exclusively looking back to the 60s and now engaging these residues that remain from these performative event practices from 40 years ago. So the first question is why, at least on at least not so much on the theoretical level, but in the art practice itself, today we've seen this huge resurgence of interest in an event that's obviously passed by. I'm interested in how you explain this kind of return to the event after uh-huh. it's passed us by. The other question kind of plays into this. As I understand, your comments are kind of witnessing this event from the 60s, say, is not nostalgic, but
precisely because you're articulating the event as something that is necessarily incomprehensible or misunderstood and requires a perpetual misreading.
Mm-hmm.
So to you, what kind of, as I understand the historicity of experience, what's interesting about the event, the reason that the avant-garde is not dead is precisely because if we read the avant-garde on the terms you've set out, it requires a perpetual rereading and a rereading. And so one can't extinguish the event in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
So if I come to this resurgence of the event from your angle, in fact, we're not being nostalgic when we kind of focus on the 60s, because there is really nothing. There's a certain incomprehensibility built into the notion of the event.
Mm-hmm.
And so that goes into this other issue of if we were to look at, in theory, other people have spoken about the event. There's Alain Badiou. And for Badiou, we were just talking about this before, there's this interesting issue of kind of how incomprehensible is the event. Is it something that is incomprehensible in its moment but becomes comprehensible after?
Mm-hmm.
Or kind of with Heidegger and others, as you suggest, is it fundamentally incomprehensible? And that's its strength.
Mm-hmm.
It's untotalizable in a way. And what is interesting in Badiou is this notion of fidelity, this notion that you have a fidelity to an event. And
mm-hmm.
so I guess the real question I have is, how can you maintain a fidelity to an event that for you is always necessarily being reread and misread?
Okay. Maybe let me start with the last one, and then I try to go back to your first question. I think that the both are interesting, very interesting, in fact. I think, you know, if I understand Badiou well, or think about this notion of fidelity to the event, I think that to be faithful to the event, right, would mean to understand, well, understand is not the right word, right, to experience the transformative force of the event, which, you know, in the changing historical circumstances will itself change. I mean, it might be the same event, you know, or the same work of art, but, you know, because history happens, as it were, the fidelity to that event would, in my sense, be always manifest itself as a somewhat different transformative effect that it would have on us. Now, to think about, as you said, you know, going back to the 60s and the Notre Dame event, one could go back even further, as I tried to do in the beginning, and go to Dada and see that, you know, that, you know, one could suggest, you know, one could try a historical explanation, and I'm not sure how good it will be, but let me try it out, right? That I think, you know, my suggestion in the historicity of experience was that the avant-garde is not only important, that it is becoming more and more important. And it is becoming more important because avant-garde, in its historical manifestations in the 1910s and 1920s, I think at least, was a response and an attempt to deal with the rapidly increasing technicization of modernity. So to the extent that this technicization keeps not only progressing but sort of spiraling on us, I think the kind of engagement that the avant-garde sought with the question of technology and how it impacts experience is becoming more and more important. So I would see, and so going back to the 1960s, not at all as nostalgia, but as precisely this intensification of the interest in the event. So that might be a historical explanation for that, you know.
Maybe if I could connect this with another question about what you have been linking systematically, the event and technology, and it's also somehow why we are here somehow. We could have recorded this earlier and screened it on, you know, on the web, or we could have just had a talk. We wanted this to be a technological event with a recording, a number of recording devices. I was thinking of a number of two, for me, recent simultaneous events in October, last October, in New York. There was simultaneously the opening of the Guggenheim show, Moving Images, with the Bill Viola piece you talk about. And at the same time, there was a discussion in the New York Public Library where French and American groups had convened to talk about the avant-garde today.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my friends, François Dominique, created, who spoke on the first day, created quite a scandal And that's quite interesting because somehow he announced a political theme that has been more recently relevant. He criticized the avant-garde as being a militaristic term. So you can recognize the French position here, I suppose. then the other French delegates were furious because they thought he was attacking them and saying that the avant-garde was dead and so on. Just to confirm somehow that there is even today among people who believe that they embody the avant-garde, either as poets, artists, and representing various magazines, exhibitions, art forms, and so on, there is still a dissensus to call up this term. But fundamentally, what I would like, using Viola precisely as an example, and especially that piece in the Guggenheim, it seems to be relatively traditional in some sense.
Yeah.
And even the quote you were you started with, Bill Viola is a video artist who could be a painter somehow. Well, how do you see this? Why do you see, let's say, for someone like Bill Viola with an almost religious discourse, an almost Jungian discourse on myth, resurrection, passion, and so on, why is this artist so successful today with this medium? Is this a coincidence or not?
I would look at it this way, right? That what's interesting for me in Viola is that he precisely is using the latest technologies, you know, trying to, at least, you know, always, you know, he's upgrading from video, you know, to high definition panels and so on, and he's very conscious of the possibilities that these new technologies give to artists, that is, the possibilities of manipulating, changing, working with the material. But, you know, he uses them, I think, often and fundamentally to precisely work with the notion of time and temporality. That is, even if you look at the moving pictures, I think, you know, the kind of the slowing down or speeding up that he often uses in his works, ultimately begins to, as it were, accentuate time and temporality in ways that are never reducible to the technological manipulation or calculation of time. That's what interests me in Viola. And I think, I don't know if one could go that far to say that somehow that may be a symptom of where we are, in some sense, that that makes Viola popular. But that's the way I tend to think about. And you're right, I mean, that some of his concerns seem very traditional. And it's true, he's been reproached for doing that. But at the same time, I think he is precisely on the cusp of working with technology and trying somehow to turn technology from within. And that's what interests me. And that's what I, you know, associated with the avant-garde. You know, I absolutely agree with you that, you know, of course, there has been and there will be controversy about the term. That's why I was trying to use the term sort of very loosely, not even in terms of the historical avant-garde or the second avant-garde and so on, but as a certain impulse in the work of art, precisely to transform experience and transform force relations that it inherits from society.
But to be more blunt, you're not bothered by the military connotation of avant-garde?
Uh-huh.
Or would you somehow defend the idea of the avant-garde today?
Not militaristic in the sense of, revolution or overthrow. But I do think that, in that book that I've been, you know, working on, the Force of Art, I have a chapter called Revolt in Art. I was trying to think what it is that art revolts against, without perhaps necessarily being violent. So I would not see the avant-garde in militaristic sense. I would see it in temporal sense. That is, that avant-garde is futural. That is, it always tries to open the work of art and experience to future and therefore to possible transformation. And it is revolting in that sense against foreclosing the future as something that may be completely different.
I want to go back to Bill Viola. to me, when I look at Bovarella's piece, if I read it against, say, Rosalind Krauss's notion of a post-medium mm-hmm. moment or a practice that would not be aligned specifically with a kind of the canvas, for mm-hmm. instance, Loyola seems shamelessly kind of conservative insofar. He's obviously not a post-medium artist to me. Mm-hmm. He's an artist that's working with the plasma screen or as one would work with the canvas or the projector. And then I go back to the 60s to kind of flip the argument, not that the 60s were nostalgic, but in mm-hmm. a way they were more avant-garde than the contemporary avant-garde. And so then I look at this text that I was showing you, Rauschenberg's kind of open score, a tennis match mm-hmm. in which Frank Stella holds a tennis racket that is filled with diodes. And as he plays this match against himself in a room that has no lights on, mm-hmm. His movement is kind of shown in infrared on another screen that 500 people are watching. And I guess the story is that this is in for a Nine Evenings program by Billy Kluver in 68. And although when I read that event, that art practice, which is constitutive precisely being an event, I don't see it as radical either in the way that I see it being remarkably ingenious in using extant technologies, mm-hmm. not necessarily questioning those technologies. Then I flip forward to the Guggenheim show with Viola, and it just seems shamelessly kind of not. It doesn't seem to accord with kind of the force work that you're laying out on a theoretical level. And I'm wondering, is there in fact an art practice that could live up to the theory that you've set out?
Uh-huh.
And is that to be found today, or is in fact bizarrely, or mm-hmm. in accordance with your historicity of experience, where we've misread the avant-garde as being progressive and dialectic when it really needs to be reread. It questions the whole notion of historicity.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of art practice could live up in a way to this theory?
Mm-hmm. I think the theory itself is imagining a certain art practice that might not necessarily be there, right? But at the same time, and it is future oriented in just the specific sense that I wanted to precisely come up with something that would try to maybe project or understand how art might still be important for us in the 21st century. Right, even if there are not necessarily specific practices that concord with that. On the other hand, I'm also quite willing, and I in a way I understand your question and I agree with you in some sense. On the other hand, I would want to be able to trace in artists that like Viola, who seem to be more traditional in some sense, nonetheless that this what I called in the historicity of experience the avant-garde impulse, I nonetheless see it there, even if in terms of technical means or the way that they sort of instantiate that kind of work, they may be more traditional than say people who really are post-medium, as you say, but nonetheless that critical force is there in their work. So I'm willing sort of to maybe not fudge the issue but play with it in this sense.
I'm thinking of other artists that were active in the past or today, in which there in fact is no residue to the practice because it is precisely an event in the mm-hmm. sense that although there are repercussions to that action or that force and that movement, there in fact is no physical residue. So it's a different kind of post-medium. Does that kind of a practice work in this way? And so, I mean, does the event, to go back to this issue, does it require witnessing?
Another very interesting question, right? In some ways, I think you're right, that the kind of conception that I've proposed almost requires a material instantiation somehow, mm-hmm. that the work be in the material. The question would be that, even if you have an event that is not instantiated in any way, it does get instantiated in terms of the accounts, or I don't know, pictures or photographs and some. But it is an interesting question, and I don't think it necessarily has to be completely instantiated in the material. I was interested in the material aspect specifically in relation to the understanding of the work of art as a commodity, right? Because it's usually along those lines that the work of art is said to be, a commodity. And I was trying to find a moment in which the work of art could resist the almost necessary commodification. And I think that if you think about the events that don't instantiate themselves materially, they try to act against that. I mean, they absolutely try to commodify themselves in that sense, you know, to refuse any ability to turn the event into a commodity, which is always an aspect of the work of art. I mean, the work of art, if it is instantiated in a material, risks becoming a commodity. It's an inherent risk to the work of art. And I think if you think about that practice of the event, you know, like a Dada event or, you know, happening, it's precisely an attempt to counter that possibility.
Maybe open to you, if you have questions, points that you'd like us to return to. It's always a difficult transition from four person.
I was wondering how you think and together the art event and the political event, in the sense that even largely we're talking about art events, but most people don't see it in that information perspective. But if you think back clearly to the birth of the avant-garde, the art event was intended to be a simultaneous political event. And today, there's probably almost no political event that doesn't have some accompanying art responding or trying to interact with it. So in some sense, almost it's two perspectives that they can go together, that there'll be a major political event and then there'll be art responding. Is there maybe a way that we don't have to think those always in couple, or we have to go backwards rather, or forwards?
Would you like to start? I mean, talking a lot, huh? Or should I?
But,
I mean, it's an enormous question. And, I always try to think about precisely those moments in art that seem to be completely disconnected from politics, that I think are really radically political. Right? That is. For example, for me, what's radically political, right, is also this idea of questioning the prevalence of the paradigm of production, manipulation, and manipulative power that sort of completely infuses our society. Right? So if the work of art does that, it is political to me, because not in the sense that it aligns itself with a political event, or it chronicles a political event, or it has a political ideology or platform, but I tend to think about it in Adorno's sense. You know, Adorno himself was very, very suspicious of the approach, for example, of someone like Lukács, who would want to see in the work of art an explicit, you know, political, I don't know, witnessing or agenda or an alternative point of view. Right. So without precluding that at all, I don't think that Adorno would preclude those aspects, you know, from being there in the work of art. He was looking for the sort of socially and politically critical aspect of the work of art on the level of form. So he thought that it is in the form that the work of art was truly radically critical. Because if you want to be critical, right, of a political program or a political event, you are already forced to work within the boundaries of the language and the discourse in which this political event is operating. So for Adorno, you're already somehow compromising your own political critique. So we need to dislodge and dislocate the very terms in which the political discourse is operating to be truly critical of the political discourse. So I tend myself sometimes to see the most political aspects of art in the layers that seem to be completely disconnected from politics, but I think are political in that specific sense. So I try to follow Adorno in this particular approach.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether I can follow here. It feels a little bit as if there was a sort of disconnect between the artistic event and the political event. In at times, it looks as if artists were running after the event or trying to promote the event. And I think it's a little the problem one has with anyone who says, I am the avant-garde now, meaning I am the event now, and there's something a little ridiculous in that position. Whereas when a real event, what we call an event, let's say 9/11 or something like that, happens, it happens as an event, as Derrida and Bayou both analyze, because precisely it was impossible somehow in advance. What makes it an event is it's the impossibility or the unthinkableness of the event. And it's, I think, art maybe looking for that kind of impossibility, but most of the time this is the problem of the avant-garde, is already reprogrammed by the program, by the manifesto, mm-hmm. and so on. And it looks as if the political domain was somehow offering a model for the avant-gardist mm-hmm. poet, writer, and so on. And I think a number of historical avant-gardists were extremely aware of this, like Wyndham Lewis and the futurists, and so on. But that doesn't really solve the issue.
Yeah, and it's an excellent question. I was thinking about it on two levels. I was thinking first, perhaps, you know, this connection and disconnection. Maybe it's important to think both the connection and disconnection between the sort of artistic event and political event, because ultimately what is at stake in this artistic event is not art kind of running after political events and describing them or even testifying them. But maybe what might be at stake in this relation and difference would be the sort of paradoxical tension that I heard when between the concept of the revolt that's usually thought as a kind of precisely active, disruptive force, and this notion that Cruz was talking about, middle voice, is neither active nor passive. And we have not yet started to think about politics in a middle voice. It's always thought of as a kind of, you know, virile and very intense activity. So probably this middle voice will be the domain of relation and difference, at least in the sense as we understand politics today. And it was in this context kind of paradoxical that the first question that Jean-Michel asked was about militaristic qualities of avant-garde and a kind of perverse quality, I find myself, of Chris's work, that he sort of stresses almost this middle voice or passive voice of the avant-garde, kind of, you know, turning away from this more, you know, Marinetti kind of virile sort of manifesto-like style.
Yes, I mean, my interest in this, you know, comes, you know, we were answering this question about the aesthetic and the political, right? But in some sense, I tend to see the question more as the aesthetic and the technological, because politics is technological in some sense. It's a matter, you know, these days it's a matter of policy, manipulation, and it's, again, it's in technological in the sense of the active making or happening. And the work of art, indeed, I try to see it as a, and it was an apt metaphor that you used, as a space of different mode of relation. That's why I was insisting on this idea of the middle voice. And when you have this sort of different space of relation, then experience, things, events, as it were, appear differently. And that's at the basis of the kind of questions that I'm trying to ask, right? Is art making, I mean, it's ultimately you could say it's a very simple question. Is art making any difference? Right? What kind of difference could art make as we go into the 21st century? So in those terms, I try to sort of understand what experience is about in the, you know, as we go into the 21st century and what possibly might be different in art. So in that sense, as I was answering one of Aaron's questions, I was saying that sort of theory, that approach is sort of deliberately projected toward the future, where we might be heading in terms of the, you know, of the direction that art is pointing us to.
Can I sort of take your question? I think it's at the beginning of that question and kind of redirect it again, to our former discussion, because I think what was really important in what you ask was this relationship between obsolescence and novelty, the characteristic of commodity culture, and into which a certain version of avant-garde, if it is coupled with this notion of radical break and so forth, falls. So I was thinking, when you asked your question about our earlier discussion about Bill Viola, about something traditional lingering there, something older, and I was thinking about perhaps when we are talking about different temporality, whether it is only future-oriented temporality, but whether there is a certain kind of return of something older, as Adorno would say, almost certain kind of archaic that is even more obsolete, that obsolete, you know, that sort of lingers and disorients this sense of futurity as well. Precisely, it's the return, even like sometimes embarrassing, I like this language, embarrassing traditional coupled with technological, to dislocate this sense of absolute new novelty for 5 seconds, you know. I wonder what that would be. What are you thinking about those terms when you ask your question?
I think it's a matter of taste. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this is where you can see a way to think of our disposition is that the past is what supports.
Yeah.
And that we can't ally ourselves with the unknown. And to do that is to ally ourselves with the kind of traumatic eruption that contains us the events of September 11th in the Margaret. And if you think about the past as before, as something that you owe to us, then everything is there as a resource. You must judge and choose. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the kind of opening art alone can
have. Yeah, I mean, in the sense that, right, if you know, if you think about even the works of art that are from the past, right? I mean, they are literally the past, right? And yet they can sometimes speak to the future, right? And I absolutely agree. I mean, I think what's interesting, you know, the temporality of the event for me is precisely, you know, goes back to the phenomenological thinking about time, that is, as always, you know, the present that is never there but is between the past and the future, and the past is always, as you said, right, it's what's projected toward the future is precisely the past. I mean, in that case, I mean, I don't know if that's the right way of thinking about it, but, you know, I could see it this way, right, that there's a certain right absence in this case, a literal sort of evacuation of something that was supposed to be staged, that nonetheless, right, gives rise to a different event that happens, you know, online, mm-hmm. right, and generates pages and pages of poems, or that generates literal events around the country. You know, there was even one at Notre Dame when there was a reading on February 12th, right, to somehow commemorate the absence of the event, right? So,
right, more than anything else that could occur, the event occurred.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think it's a little what Susan was suggesting with the Heideggerian, one might say, idea of a site to let time and passivity happen. And as I think in Christoph's discourse, a very interesting and exciting attempt at really blending the opposites of Heidegger's version of let things be, let being be, let's think of the gods, man, the Gefährt, and this space in which the models are not particularly avant-gardistic. Hölderlin, mm-hmm. Tycho, Van Gogh, although there's a presence of madness there. and Adorno's teleology of the historicity of forms, because I think this is the one important issue. Can there be a formal event? And I think the avant-garders always believe that the form could be an event, like a new form. What's the new form? Mm-hmm. And the form that will break with the past, and so on. And I think in that sense, for Adorno, clearly, there are regressive forms. And I don't know whether you would agree or not with this, but it seems to me that we now have become more tolerant of regressive forms. Mm-hmm. And even if we can say that indeed there are regressive elements, at least for me, in Viola, there is an event, there is a new concept. It can be extremely traditional, like the slow motion faces at the Metropolitan, but it is an event nevertheless somehow, because it lets something else happen, which, mm-hmm. as you said, and I think this was also the common point of most of the pieces that were exhibited at the Guggenheim, that they were using the medium of film precisely to show what is not shown in contemporary film, let's say Hollywood and so on, entertainment. It's interesting to be in these little rooms, and you would have things that an uninitiated, I'm going to see a little film. But in fact, the point of the film generally was to show either texture, skin, and so on, or time, or bodies, or silence, or so everything that has been, because of the commodification of entertainment today, transformed and eliminated in order to produce the mass entertainment in which everything is streamlined and so on. So in that sense, the event as form becomes a very complex and complicated, has been complicated by Adorno and Heidegger. I think indeed, like you, that both are necessary to think it together.
In Adorno, I think force is indeed sort of referred to. He talks about physics, but you know, there is also this conception of force that comes from Nietzsche and goes to a certain extent through Heidegger to people like Deleuze and Foucault. But it's a different story. But you know, in terms of Viola, I think that you know what I see in his work, and I think it, and I hope it's really there, right? Is precisely a response to the ways in which we can manipulate time and experience. And what I found interesting in some of his installations is that he precisely will use some of the new technological ways of manipulating time and experience to show that there is an aspect of time and experience which falls out of manipulation, that it cannot be manipulated. So what I was interested in seeing in Viola was using technology to show a certain limit to technology. And I was trying to see that as a you know, in Heidegger's terms, as a turn within technology. Because in the question concerning technology, Heidegger says that perhaps we'll reach a moment in which technology will allow us to mark a certain turn within technology. And I was trying to see that perhaps Viola is operating in, you know, in that kind of terrain, using technology in order to show us an aspect of experience that cannot be technologized, in the sense that it cannot be manipulated, it cannot be programmed, it cannot be reprogrammed, it cannot be processed. Even though in his creation he's using precisely that. It's sort of like when I cited Adorno, when he was trying to understand the work of art as using domination in order to produce non-domination.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah. Or, you know, to use domination against itself or manipulation against itself and turn it. Another, you know, example that I would cite would be that that Jean-Michel mentioned that I didn't mention in my presentation, obviously because of lack of time, is that Brazilian artist Eduardo Kac, who lives in Chicago, and who uses genetic technology to produce what he calls transgenic works of art. And sometimes I see what he accomplishes as art. Sometimes I'm sort of dubious about it. But it's precisely this idea, I think, of taking a work of taking technology. Like he had this, he called it Genesis. He took a line from the Bible, translated it into the Morse code, then correlated it with the amino acids, had a gene synthesized on the basis of the string of amino acids, called it the art gene, and put it into a bacteria. So he was using thoroughly scientific methods, as it were, to play with science and with technology. And that's what interests me, sort of, in contemporary art, if it is capable of doing that, as it were, turning technology on its head to a certain extent, while using it, obviously.
I want to kind of return to a skeptical point. in another sense, Bill Vallo's piece at the Guggenheim was an event insofar as it was the first time that I'm aware of that a high definition or a digital piece of video was so expensive that it required multiple institutions to purchase it. So what was interesting about this piece was that the Guggenheim actually doesn't own it, although they commissioned it. In fact, it was jointly purchased. The other thing that was interesting about it was that although digital, I mean, although kind of an object that can be reproduced ad infinitum, nevertheless, it fetched a price that, or it kind of required institutions to work together as if it were a static object. I guess the question comes back to this notion of Adorno and the limit to a technology. And my kind of maybe unpredictable question is, how can one espouse an art practice that is simultaneous, the content kind of challenges a limit, while at the same time it requires for its kind of, for this career artist to distribute the work, a remarkable complicity with not limit, but conformity. And this is a problem that all mm-hmm. kind of successful artists face. Can you, in fact, be an avant-garde artist, but also be valued by the market?
Yes, you know, I think it can happen. I mean, my sense is that, you know, as I said, answering your earlier question, right, that the sort of, I called it the risk of commodification is inherent to the work of art, you know, and it can be seen as something bad, but it also has its good aspects, right? That an installation like the one that we had at the Guggenheim was made possible by that, right? And it's I think it's inevitable that you'll see influx of more money as, you know, technology becomes sort of more expensive and more technology enters art. I think you know, this is the necessity of our times. At the same time, right? If you think about, you know, there's something else as you mentioned that exhibit by Viola, right? If you think about those, I don't know if anybody saw it here, but it's five panels, right, running simultaneously, and each panel runs for 35 minutes, I think. If you imagine how much time you would have to spend there to actually sit in front of each panel and see that happen, I think that's, in a way, you could say it's, you know, to go back to what Eva was saying, it's almost kind of an archaic sense of experience, but it precisely becomes critical because it flies in the face of the kind of foreshortening and manipulation of experience when you have 30-second commercials, right, and everything gets sort of channeled this way. Suddenly when Viola does something like that, it becomes quote-unquote radical by virtue of being traditional. And that's what I liked about this piece, right? So I don't think anybody spent almost 3 hours there, you know, looking at that, you know, how much of your time you would have to devote.
An hour and a half, almost.
We spent an hour and a half, yeah.
Anyway, I think the part of the idea is that you are missing something because you're supposed to see the five at the same time.
At the same time, it's impossible, yeah.
To watch one and then the other and so on. So you're always missing something interesting. And
you're always too late. You
know, I was warned by somebody who had seen it in advance when you see a corpse suddenly rising out of the water. But I could see half the room was full of people who hadn't seen it because they were watching people walking in a wood and nothing happened. And I think this is a good way somehow of problematizing the event, because in these films some are eventless, others have suddenly a rupture, yeah. And so on. But it leads me maybe to the other example that you analyze at some length of Roland. She's somebody I had known a long time ago when she was just beginning, you know, video artist in Dijon. And as a video artist, she would play with her body. But I think she became more the avant-garde when she decided to play with plastic surgery. So again, involving a body and the transformation, as you may have seen, the little bumps that she has grafted on her forehead and so on. But it was also when she was recorded live in New York and broadcast in Paris and so on. So there was not just playing with her body in a sort of unconscionable and almost psychotic fashion, but there was the fact that she was able to transform the event into the technological event. So, mm-hmm. So there was this horror at seeing the body really opened and the wounds, the plastic surgeons and so on, but knowing very well that it was part of a huge spectacle with a lot of money. In that sense, money is part of the spectacle.
Yeah, it is. I mean, to go back briefly to that Viola exhibit, since we are sort of going back or around it, there's another aspect, right? The way that the thing is set up in this one room, right? Not only you can't follow the five panels simultaneously, but you have people circulating in the room that keep disrupting the whole thing. So somehow the audience gets inscribed into the piece, and this is another unexpected sort of moment that, you know, maybe because he's so popular, so many people come up there, you know, and become part of that, you know, and part of the disruption of the seemingly sort of a very self-contained event. And then on HBO, yeah.
So it's on Broadway, and then it's, of course, it takes 45 hours or 60 hours. Like 45 hours. And, you know, so it's for that audience, and then what happens with the. What would be the timing on that phenomenon? That's the non HBO event, now that there's one Broadway, and the most particularly the entire establishment, right? How would you perform?
I'm not sure what the future is. I mean, the interesting question would be to what extent the fact that an event like that gets embedded into a commercial enterprise undercuts the event or not. I mean, in some ways, you're right that it may limit the audience in some ways, but I think the audience is already limited in some sense for that event. But the question for me would be, what's the relationship between the commercial enterprise in which it gets embedded and the kind of, you know, socio-political resonance that it might have nonetheless?
And the products get produced from that, sales of the
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when you are talking, I mean, I was thinking about Adorno, who was probably most honest of all the theoreticians to say that, you know, art faces double whammy, you know, if it's completely outside the structures of commodity, it's inconsequential. If it enters into those structures, it becomes more and more complicitous. So it's the question is, and that's what he meant, that was what was at stake in this formulation, heteronomous autonomy of the work of art, that art is both dependent and complicitous, and yet despite the fact can retain a certain degree of autonomy, and it's a question of degree of autonomy. And that's a different kind of event. It has to be negotiated each time, and sometimes those negotiations are completely unpredictable in terms of... Yes. But see, that's also another very interesting point about art making a difference. It's about the question, in particular in your response, for me, is about intentionality. Because it's a clash between, say, artists wanted to make a difference, and what is the status of art at this moment? Art is a social institution, right? So, and it's always the clash between the two. It's not just artists wanting to make a difference, but what is the status of the Broadway, and what is the status of poetry and avant-garde poetry? What is the status of the Broadway show? That is the kind of triangulation that, right?
I would put it also this way, right, that if we want to think about art in terms of the middle voice, whether it makes a difference is ultimately not up to the artist. I mean, it's not, you know, equivalent to the artist's intention for all, you know, the...
Exactly.
Sometimes something that may not be at all intended to make a difference does make a difference. So it's something is out of our hands. It's not under... We cannot manipulate quite, you know, art this way. And that's precisely why art is interesting, because it resists manipulation in this way, even by the artist. I think it's a continuous negotiation.
I think at least the artistic event is harder to ascertain. And if we compare with what we call events in ordinary language, we assume that they are already mediated by television, networks, news, newspapers, and so on. Whereas for the artistic event, not so many people are ready to grant, let's say, critics the right to say what is an event, because clearly their taste, value judgments interfere. And so we are more or less in the same situation, but that nobody really knows what an event is, because somebody will always come and will have, like Pound said, his ideogram of what is beautiful, and will quote five names with poets, with artists, and so on. Have you seen that? Have you read that? And you will see that somehow the event is determined by these names, or, as we say, a show, and so on. But it's much more, how should I say, evanescent. There's no consensus somehow about the event there, which maybe also what justifies our talking about it now.
Well, I guess we can come to a conclusion with this event.
Perfect.
Propagate.